Welcome to episode 17 of Physicians Beyond the Bedside. I am Norm Chapin, your host. I'd like to welcome those of you who are finding the podcast for the first time and welcome back those of you that have been in my audience in the past. I have a great interview for you today on the show. The interview is with Dr. Dyke Drummond. Dyke tells the story of how he transitioned from clinical medicine into his current non-clinical role. As a coach, Dyke provides a tremendous amount of support for physicians across the country. He will provide us today with valuable insights into lessons he has learned as he has transitioned from a clinical role into his current non-clinical role.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Beyond the Bedside. I am your host, Dr. Norm Chapin. Beyond the Bedside is a podcast that will help you find a non-clinical role and take your career in new, rewarding, and sometimes unanticipated directions. I'm very happy that you are here to learn about opportunities beyond the bedside.
Welcome to another episode of Physicians Beyond the Bedside. Today, I'm pleased to welcome Dr. Dyke Drummond, CEO of The Happy MD, as my guest today. On episode 15 of Physicians Beyond the Bedside, we discussed burnout and moral injury. Dyke is a physician with a tremendous amount of experience working with and coaching physicians with burnout. Dyke, welcome to Physicians Beyond the Bedside.
Thanks, Norm. Great to be here. Just a quick clarification. My website is called thehappymd.com. I am not the happy MD. I give people tools so they can be a happy MD or DO or RN.
Right. Well, thank you for that clarification. And I'll make sure that we include your website in the show notes. I think there's a lot of valuable information there that I've seen, and I think my audience will appreciate that link. So we'll include that below in the show notes.
Right on.
So first of all, maybe you could start by telling my audience a little bit about what you do.
Okay, so I'm a family doc at Mayo Med School, UC Davis in California, residency, 10 years of private practice in Mount Vernon, Washington, which is about halfway between Seattle and Vancouver, BC. And I was an old school do-everything doc, admitted all my own patients, delivered all the ladies who were pregnant in my practice, delivered 500 babies. Ultimately, 1999, when I was 40 years old, I crashed and burned just spectacularly in my practice. In my particular case, my mother and her mother, so two generations of powerful women, had wanted me to be a doctor, but never said it in my presence. They were never haranguing me for it. But at that point, when I was 40, I'd been a family doc for 10 years, 35,000 patient visits. It was starting to lose its shine, and both my mom and my grandma were dead. And so my practice came to a screaming halt. Every day for a couple of weeks when I'd go in the office, it felt like somebody was choking me. I took a month-long sabbatical. It didn't go away, and I walked away from my medical career. I actually walked in after my sabbatical on the first day, signed my resignation, and walked away from my medical career, which I don't recommend as a transition strategy. So if you're listening to me and you say, I'm going to chuck it too, just like he did, please don't do what I did. It just burns too many bridges, especially if you've got any thoughts about, given the name of the podcast, if you've got any thoughts about a peaceful transition into a different career, please don't walk away from the great means of support that your practice could be in that transition. And we can talk about ways that you can make the change without having to walk away. And then between 2000, I got certified as a coach immediately. So I have a coaching certificate. I'm an executive coach, ICF certified, interactive guided imagery. And I worked in the walk-in clinics to put food on the table for about 3 or 4 years. And then at that point in time, my now ex-wife had gotten certified as a facilitation skills trainer. And she was teaching people how to run better meetings. And we ended up being faculty to the United States Navy's Lean Six Sigma Black Belt certification program. So I learned how to run a business. I learned how to make a website, hire and manage people, learned a whole bunch of skills I didn't learn in medical school. And then in 2010, when that marriage and that business went away, I was burnt to the ground for the second time. And I decided, because I finally realized that burnout is what took me out, maybe I can start a coaching practice and make a living coaching burned out doctors. Launched thehappymd.com. And I've been doing this for 10 years. And unfortunately, I've been riding a wave of burnout prevalence and burnout severity and larger medical groups. I mean, you now are involved in CMOing 3 hospital staffs. Well, those people weren't employed by the hospital 10 years ago. That's a modern phenomenon. So at this point in time, I've trained about 40,000 doctors for 175 organizations on how to prevent burnout, wrote a book. We have 5 coaches in our program, and we're getting ready to launch a new premium coaching, 6-month premium coaching program in the new year to help people recognize and prevent burnout and to maintain a connection with a passion that had them choose medicine in the first place. Because right now, everything about the modern practice of industrial medicine is driving them away from that passion. And that's the tragedy of burnout.
So I was going to ask you how you became interested in burnout and moral injury, but it sounds like you didn't recognize immediately that what was that your problem, this choking sensation that you had and how you crashed and burned, was really related to burnout. And
right.
It took you some time to do that. How long did it take you, and how did you finally come to that realization?
Years, man. Great question. Well, first of all, doctors are programmed to burn out by our medical education. We're set up to fall. We're set up to ignore our stress levels and our energy levels. We're set up to ignore our own self-care because of several prime directives that are installed as the programming of medical education. Programming. What do I mean? Brainwashing. So let's talk about a situation where we know that people are being programmed. Let's talk about basic training in the military. Do you know how long basic training lasts? You personally?
12 weeks, I think.
That's one service. It's 6 to 13 weeks, depending on the branch of the service. But we all know we're programming young recruits so that at the end, they'll do whatever I ask them to do, anything. Yep. And I don't even have to be nice because they see it as an order that they have to follow. How long does classic medical education take? Let me just ask you, Norm, from the first day of your medical school till you were out and board certified and practicing, how many years was it?
It was 7 years for me.
7 times 52 is what? That's 350 weeks. Do you think
that's
you were
not
conditioned?
A fair question.
Do you think you were conditioned just a little bit?
Yeah, sure.
And part of it is the two prime directives. Everybody knows the first prime directive. The patient comes first. And the patient comes first is the root of all evil when it comes to burnout, if there is no off switch. Because we will all agree the patient cannot come first 24/7, 365, and you be a normal human being. But the second prime directive that nobody ever says out loud, unless I'm the one who's talking, is never show weakness. Never do anything to make anybody suspect you haven't got what it takes. You're not a team player. You're not pulling your weight. And so that, combined with the fact that when you get out of your residency program, you take your first job, you had nothing to do with designing that job description. It is not customized to match your makeup, your skills, your strengths, your purpose, your passion. You are going to burn out. It is inevitable. And at any point in time these days, at any individual point in time, snapshot, like a chest x-ray, anytime you want to survey a population of doctors today, you're going to find 50% of them are burned out right now. And we're recording this in October of 2021 as the Delta wave goes away.
So the length of time that it took you from experiencing burnout until you actually realized you had it is a problem I assume that other physicians have as well. How does a physician really assess and know if they're suffering from burnout? How did you eventually learn that?
Now, the challenge is that when you are burned out, exhausted, physically challenged to continue, like the little voice in your head will say something like, I'm not sure how much longer I can keep going like this. What ends up happening is the way we're programmed is we actually look in the mirror and say, what's wrong with me? And we feel guilty about taking time. That's that never show weakness programming. But let me just say, and people always want to skip this basic education, but let's talk about the 3 symptoms of burnout because it's really important to recognize it. Most people will mistake exhaustion for burnout, but exhaustion is only one of the symptoms of burnout. Physical and emotional exhaustion. Little voice in your head will say something like, I'm not sure how much longer I can keep going like this. Your significant other will typically be concerned about you, typically for quite a while now when you come to realize it. The second symptom, cynical, sarcastic, compassion fatigue, having to vent about your patients before you can go back to caring for them. which is disturbing because you realize you're actually venting and making fun of the people you're supposed to be taking care of. Patient comes first. It's like, oh my God, what have I become, right? Third, what's the use? My work's not really serving a purpose here. And another expression of the third symptom of burnout is when somebody says, I'm concerned that if something doesn't change, I'm going to make a mistake and somebody's going to get hurt. So exhausted, cynical, and sarcastic, what's the use? The doctor goes into survival mode, which is much easier to recognize in somebody else than it is in you. Survival mode. You go to bed at night praying you'll feel better in the morning, and you don't. And so you drag your ass out of bed, you get ready to see patients that day, and you may have the little voice in your head say something like, you know, maybe if I'm lucky, I'll get hit by a car on the way to work and won't have to see patients today. But I've never seen that actually happen, right? And by the way, that little voice saying is a huge red flag. If you ever hear that in your head, or if you ever have somebody say it out loud, please don't laugh, although it is a little bit funny. Grab them, hold them, hug them, and have them look in the mirror and take a reality check here. Because what ends up happening is you stagger from patient to patient through the day, drag your sorry butt home, praying you're better tomorrow. And unless you change your actions, unless you do something different, you're in Einstein's insanity trap, and it's just going to stay there. But it takes a while, and it's easier to see in other people. You just have to remember that. So let me just drive that nail all the way. So listening to me right now, who are you worried about? I know you're worried about somebody. Who are you worried about that might be burned out? It might not be a doctor, might be a nurse, might be one of your administrators, okay? Before we're done here today, I'm going to teach you how to reach out to them, because what I want you to do is reach out to them, because they aren't aware of the burnout in the way you are.
So the physician who, it's easier for us to see it in other people. You're going to talk a little bit about how we reach out to other people, but how do we get a physician who typically is trying not to show signs of weakness, and they're trying to sort of power through this feeling and make excuses for the feeling, sometimes coming up with some pretty creative excuses from what I've seen in the past, without really recognizing what the root cause of their problem is?
Well, and I know that I'm speaking to an administrator. So I know that you have been, let's call it, the beneficiary of a bunch of bad behavior by overstressed and burned out doctors. And I know that in your heart, you would like to be a part of the addressing that helpfully. They're not going to listen to you. So I'm talking about people who are listening right now, your peers. You're going to be one of the frontline working docs that's going to reach out. And what's interesting is, and let's just do the role play. Okay. Here's the reason this is important. Physician suicides are double the number of suicides of folks that are not doctors. So your choice to be a light worker back in the day when you decided to go to medical school rather than do anything else, that choice doubled your suicide risk. And that number is low. It's probably significantly more than doubled. We can't prevent all suicides because, number one, doctors are really good at hiding their distress. And number two, we know the anatomy and physiology, so we're really good at killing ourselves. So you can't stop all suicides, but what you can do is reach out to everyone you're worried about, that you're concerned about, which is why I asked you, who are you concerned about? And here's one way to reach out to them. First of all, you never have this conversation unless you're alone with this person. You don't want anybody to see or hear that you're talking to them. Ask permission. Hey, Norm, have you got a minute? Norm says, sure. What's up, Dyke? The first thing I do is I put my hand on my head and I mime that I'm taking off a hat. So I put my hand on my head and I act like a big arm motion, like I'm taking off my hat. And I say, Norm, well, first of all, I'm taking my doctor hat off now. And I mime taking it off and setting it to the side. In your case, Norm, you'd have to say, I'm taking my CMO hat off. I'm taking my CMO hat off. You want to take the rank out of your conversation. And then I would say, Norm, it's just you and me, heart to heart. I've been watching you and I'm concerned about you, buddy. I'm concerned. How are you doing? To which our mysterious Dr. Norm is almost certainly going to answer what? What's he going to say? He's going to say,
I'm doing great.
Fine. They can actually be upset that you asked. So I've had people say, what are you talking about? Get lost. Me? I'm fine. You ought to check Cheryl though, because she looks like trash. right? What I'm telling you is that them honestly answering your question, or is that their programming? It's typically their programming. If you're going to reach out, you have to expect intense denial. That's normal. And it does not mean you did anything wrong.
So how do you get them to take off their defensiveness? How do you, let's say I tell you, I'm doing fine, Dyke. I'm really having a good week. Everything's going well. The wife and I are having a good time. We're going on a date night tonight. How do you move past that if I'm in denial and you're still concerned about me?
You know, I've never had a doctor be in denial and do that kind of gentle, persuasive, trying to convince me that everything's okay. Normally, they're going to tell you to F off and mind your own business. And at that point in time, you're going to still be concerned. And what you do is, as long as you're concerned, you reach out again in a week or two. And they may reject you every other week for a whole year, but what is the signal that you've sent?
That you care and that you are worried about them.
And I'm here. And if you want to talk, let's talk. I'll buy you a cup of coffee. You're sending a message of support and awareness. I'm watching you. I'm concerned. If you want to talk, I'm here. And most people don't get that kind of a supportive message from their peers, especially if they're physicians in a healthcare delivery workplace. You can't make somebody who's asleep wake up by shaking them. It works if it's just sleep, but not if it's their programming that's driving them into burnout. They have to be at a teachable moment. But I encourage you, these are conversations you would never have in medical school or residency. Probably it may be different these days. But as partners out in practice, you can have each other's back in a different way. And the thing that's really important is you be aware that us looking in from the outside, we often make the mistake of granting the person that we're talking to consciousness. So notice the way you just spoke, and it's a really common speech pattern. What can I do if this person won't wake up to the fact that they're burned out? It's like, well, you're assuming they know they're burned out and they're consciously rejecting your effort. And what I'm saying is they're overstressed and they're scared. Don't grant people consciousness when it's probably not there. So to assume that a person knows they're burnt out, in that knowledge, they're still rejecting you is typically not what's going on inside the doctor. What's going on is they're lost, they're scared, they're confused. They've never felt this way before. In residency, they got close, but now it's even worse. What the heck is going on? I can't ask for help. They'll find out. Here comes imposter syndrome, right? What if they find out and you come in and call them on it? It can be scary to them. It doesn't mean that they know what's going on and they're refusing you. They're lost. And that's why you want to gently keep asking, hey, Norm, how's it going this week, man? I got my doctor hat off again. How's it going this week? What do you drink? Vanilla latte? Remind me, right? Super gentle stuff.
I have a special offer for you today. I have created a list of the top 10 skills physicians need to be maximally effective in leadership roles. The skills I included on the list have been studied and found to increase the effectiveness of leaders in all organizations. You need to cultivate these skills when you assume a leadership role. Physicians are leaders not only in clinical settings, but in non-clinical settings as well. These skills will benefit you whether you are at the bedside or beyond. Please visit my website at beyondthebedside.net/top10leadership skills for your free copy of this excellent resource today. I will also place a link to this resource in the show notes. Feel free to click on that in the show notes below. So let's say that, and my podcast is about physicians beyond the bedside, physicians who are interested in non-clinical roles. And as I'm talking to a lot of physicians, I do find that one of the main drivers, at least that I see today, is this burnout issue, that it's sort of making physicians think that the pasture's greener somewhere else. Do you see that all the time when you're coaching? And how do you help physicians, A, decide whether that's really the best thing for them to leave clinical medicine and choose a non-clinical career, or whether to stay and restore the joy of medicine in the field that they chose and that they've had years of satisfaction from?
In my experience, pretty much everybody that I meet who hires me as a coach are convinced they're going to have to leave this job to feel better. Now, most of them are not contemplating leaving medicine, but they are contemplating leaving this job. But the people that I work with, 70% of the time, recover without changing jobs. They recover in situ, if you will. And the people who do have to change jobs, the 30% who have to change jobs, always have a problem with their boss. So the defining feature of job change, in my experience, is a bad boss, an absent boss, a psychopath boss, an incompetent boss. And that's in alignment with what we know in every other industry where people say people don't quit the company, they quit their boss. And it's right. True. I've seen it over and over and over again.
Is there a pattern that you've seen in terms of which type of boss behavior is the most challenging for physicians, especially when they're burned out?
Psychopaths. Right? Okay. Psychopaths, right? The psychopath is somebody who doesn't have a conscience, so they're incapable of empathy. And they typically run, they walk through the world winning. They have to win. And so the only thing worse than a psychopath boss, and there isn't much worse, is an absent boss. You need a boss to help you get something for your practice, and there's nobody there. And a lot of organizations have grown so quickly, there's a lot of holes in org charts around the country. I know that the quickest way to any sort of satisfaction for my client is to quit immediately if I hear this story. Dyke. This person, and it could be their boss, it could also be a coworker, it could also be a receptionist. It doesn't matter. This person is literally making my life a living hell. And every time I say that to anybody in the office, they say to me something like this: "You're talking about Cheryl? What are you talking about? Cheryl's awesome." That's how you know you got a psychopath in your midst, where one person's being tortured and everybody else thinks they're awesome. That's a class four psychopath. If you're in a leadership position like you, Norm, anybody comes into you and complains that somebody's making their life the living hell and everybody else says they're great, I just want you to know you better investigate the claims the person's making who's being tortured, because I'm pretty sure that's a psychopath. And it would probably help your whole organization if you could get them out of there. That's just really difficult.
So that's a physician that you would, in that situation, the really the only solution for that physician is to leave that boss, find another job or another environment that they can be successful in.
And let me just say, too, that the people that I typically end up working with are people who say two things to me when I meet them. I love my patients. I hate my job. So most of the people I work with don't want to stop being a doctor. They want to find a place where they can reconnect with what they enjoy about being a doctor. And the whole system and leadership team is not against them.
If you had had this type of coaching when you had your severe burnout, do you think it would have made a difference? Would you have stayed in clinical medicine?
Yes. First of all, I've become the person I would have really liked to meet when I was 40 years old. And I would have almost certainly been in a senior leadership position here at this point in time. And given my entrepreneurial proclivities, it would probably be in one of these rapidly growing concierge or FQHC, really entrepreneurial FQHC settings. I consider myself to still be a doctor. People say you're not a doctor anymore. Well, all my patients are doctors. I'm still extremely loyal to and defensive of our profession. I think we're entering a phase where we're seeing the passing of the torch to a completely different way of practicing medicine that I'm completely unfamiliar with. When the boomer docs are gone, what's medicine going to look like? Is it going to be a holographic projection of McSteamy and a computer animated voice? You tell me. Let's get back to do you have to leave? So whether you leave this job or whether you stay and recover, everything is predicated on you making a 180-degree switch in your awareness. Because when you're overstressed and burned out, your fight or flight reflex is triggered. And what you're focused on is all the things you hate about this job, all the things you want to avoid and run away from. And so people, when they come to me, are always going to tell me about all the stuff that sucks. And what I say is, that's great. And I do want to hear that, but I don't want to hear it first, because you can avoid everything you don't want and you still won't get what you want. Because the only way to get what you want is to figure out what that is and go get it. In my world, that what you want is called an ideal practice description. And the first thing we have them do is sit down and write down for me the components of your practice that you would like to experience. What would you run towards if it was available? And to be very specific, what kind of patients do you want to be seeing, doing what kind of stuff, for what kind of hours and what kind of pay, on what kind of team and what kind of organization, where in the world? And most of the time I get an open mouth stare when I ask that question, because nobody's ever asked it, because nobody's ever cared. They didn't care in medical school. They didn't care in residency, and they do not care where you are now. But when you get clear on your ideal job description, you can start moving in that direction, because 70% of the time, there's enough wiggle room where you are that you can take your job satisfaction, which on a scale of 10 might now be 2, 3, 4, up to 6, 7, 8 in 7 or 8 months with some little tiny changes and a little bit of communication with your leadership team. That's my experience.
So that helps 70% of the people who are burned out to recover from it over a period of, you said, 7 to 8 months, and kind of reestablish that sense of enjoyment that they lost as the burnout sort of crept into their life.
Yeah, think about it as a whirlwind. Every time anybody in healthcare, but we're talking about doctors right now, but everybody has this. Every time you walk into work, it's a whirlwind. Stuff coming at you from all directions. And right now, the whirlwind is so full of stuff that it pushes us all to the cliff edge. And if you can make just a couple of, if you can, we're at the tipping point. If you can make a couple of changes to unload your whirlwind, maybe get better templated in your EMR, do the schedule hack and do your life calendar every week when you're at home, have a boundary ritual to separate work from home so you can effectively recharge. You pull yourself back from the cliff edge and start feeling better about your practice and start feeling better that you actually have some ability to control your practice and control how you feel when you're at work.
As you were talking, I thought of a question that I hadn't really planned on asking you, but there are so many different specialties in medicine today, and some seem to be easier to modify the work schedule, have a little more control for the physician. In your coaching experience, which specialties are most amenable to the process that you just described?
It can be done inside any specialty. However, I believe there's a few more degrees of freedom when you're in primary care. And there's also alternate practice models that work best in primary care. If you want to be a doctor, but you don't want to be in the industrial high overhead medical system. So industrial medicine, which is the kind of medicine that you CMO over, is high volume, high overhead. And the thing that drives the physician volume is the need to satisfy the overhead. The difference between high volume, high overhead industrial medicine and concierge is just one thing: overhead. If I don't have to bill $1.5 million to collect $1.2 million and give 70% of it to the hospital that employs me, you know what? I can really cut back on my patient volumes and spend more time and have more fun. So that's what drives the concierge business model.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think of intensivists, ER physicians, trauma surgeons, those types of specialties. You're right. They're in a high overhead business, but the nature of their business is so chaotic and so much more difficult to control what you're seeing and how often you're seeing it, the frequency of the visits. It's all dependent on something other than your choice, right? You're working an ED shift and you take what you get.
Let's just throw away the word control, because you have none. You're exposing right. yourself to whatever walks in the door for that shift, but there's also a break point. The other thing you have to remember is that every fiber of the organization may be driving them to overextend themselves because they also are highly remunerated. And those people, if you imagine a 50-year-old trauma surgeon, went to medical school when he was 22, he's been doing this for 30 years. They also can be absolutely traumatized and yet driven to seek out even more and higher levels of drama and income. They might have a nut back at home where they have to make $50,000 a month just to pay the bills on the private school and all that kind of stuff. So there's all sorts of things that come into play into people's burnout and behavior.
Well, that's great. This is great information. I wanted to talk with you a little bit about a growing body of literature that I've seen, and that is differentiating burnout from moral injury. And I'd like to get your thoughts on that.
Well, let me oversimplify it and say moral injury is any time that a physician evaluates a patient and has a treatment plan. They know what they want to do, and they know what the optimal therapy is in this circumstance, and they cannot do it. I know what's, let's just use some absolute terms. I know what's right in this situation, and something's stopping me. Now, there are a number of different kinds of moral injury because there are a number of different reasons why you might not be able to do what you want. The patient doesn't have any insurance. The patient has insurance, but they won't pay for that thing. We don't have that thing here. We have 10 of those things, and they're all taken. Are you with me? So we have 10 ventilators, and this is the fifth person in the waiting list, right? But he's 18 and that person's 92. Okay. All these kinds of ethical binds and stuff. And what ends up happening is when the patient doesn't get treated, especially if they have a bad outcome, you're injured in, you got hit right in the morals, so to speak, right? And that is a specific kind of purpose-based, meaning-based, spirit-based injury. Now, it's one cause of stress that leads to burnout. Every doctor's stress matrix is different, and everyone's prevention strategy for burnout is different. Let me give you another scenario. I've got a 32-year-old OBGYN woman in a four-person group who just had twins, and she's just come back from 2 months off maternity leave. And her husband's a traditional kind of guy that doesn't pitch in very much. And because she's proud and wants to be a good mom, she doesn't have an au pair. That's not any less stress than a trauma surgeon. And it will lead to burnout in exactly the same way because moral injury happens on the job. But if you can't come home and recharge, or if you go home and home is, it will end up showing up as burnout and overwhelm at work.
So you're saying that moral injury leads to burnout.
Is one cause, is one source of stress that could cumulatively with other things lead to burnout.
Because I see people writing about moral injury as though it is a term that they consider to be synonymous with burnout.
Whatever. Well, I'm not an academic. I'm a coach, okay?
Yes.
So academics are splitters. They split things into finer and finer detail and say more studies needed because they get paid to be academics. I'm a coach. I get paid for transformation. So what's going on? Well, there's some moral injury. Okay, what do you want to do about that? What else you got? Oh, I got a new kid. Okay, what do you want to do about that? By the way, I don't save people. It's not my responsibility to decide what they do. I just ask questions. I help them step out of the whirlwind to be with me on the phone every other week. And I ask questions, and outside of their whirlwind, we plan on what we're going to do differently when they go back.
So the nomenclature is not important in what you're doing.
No.
Okay.
So let's just be really clear. Everyone has a stress matrix. If you want, you can grab a piece of paper, write down my stress matrix, and sit with your significant other, because you've got blind spots. I would have your significant other with you and say, what are all the things that stress you at work? Write them all down, dump them out of your head. What are all the things that stress you at home? And what else? And you're going to write down everything that is a source of stress to you. Cumulatively, that stress, if it drives you into a negative energy balance, burnout is the only possible result. There could be any one of 100 different kinds of stress in that matrix. We've talked about a couple of them. Some of these are universal stresses. There's 5 of them that we've discovered, universal stresses that everybody has to deal with. And then there's hundreds of other ones. So for example, I'm noticing you and I happen to be big old white guys. And I think we probably are American born. English is our native language, right? And so for instance, one of the stresses we have not had to deal with is any sort of bias and discrimination ever. But if I'm looking at, you know, a 32-year-old petite, attractive African-American woman who was born in Nigeria and English is her second language, boy, oh boy, has she had to fight her way through a whole bunch of bias and discrimination to get where she is. And it may actually be a major contributor to her burnout.
That makes sense.
And I could go, there's just hundreds of different things. But once you've identified what your stress is, the question is, are you at a point where you can contemplate which one do you want to take action on? And are you at a point where you can contemplate taking a new action? Because it's only with a new action that you can get a new result and figure out how to lower that stress and perhaps build a more ideal practice.
So physicians are relatively competitive, and we tend to always like to bite off more than we can chew. Is it challenging to get physicians to limit the scope of what they're going to try to attack, even when they're in the midst of burnout?
Very insightful. Yes. So one of the things that I do when we discuss a concept, one of the things I always have to do is I have to say, okay, now, what did you learn and what are you going to do differently? Remember, just one thing, smaller is better. One of the prompts that we use, one of the metaphors we use is the plate spinning theory of personal development, plate spinning. Plate spinners can get 20 plates in the air, but they do it in a very specific fashion, one at a time. And if you feel any hesitancy to choose an action step, it's probably because it's too big. Look down at your feet and take a smaller step. Because everybody that I work with is on the edge of the burnout cliff. We don't want what they're planning on doing to be the thing that tips them over.
I can see that. I mean, I can see that in myself. When I am overloaded, I tend to just muscle through it. And if I've got to do something to fix the problem, I'm going to do it all at once, right? And it oftentimes is counterproductive.
If your only tool is a hammer, everything looks like a nail, and physicians' only tool that they've used ever since they started medical school is simply to work harder.
Great. Well, this has been really helpful. I know you mentioned at the beginning of the show that you had written a book about physician burnout, mm-hmm. I assume?
Yep.
What is the title of the book, and where can my listeners access that?
The book's called Stop Physician Burnout, What to Do When Working Harder Isn't Working. And we've sold about 40,000 copies. You can get it at Amazon. If you want three or more copies, come to the website and hit the tab that says book, because we can save you about 40%. And we ship books all over the country. And then the website is thehappymd.com, thehappymd.com. And we have five coaches, a very diverse, wonderful group of coaches that I personally have trained. They're all ICF certified coaches and highly experienced clinicians. And then our retreats, we're going to be doing a retreat at the Shawnee Inn in Pennsylvania on the Delaware River in the spring of next year. There's just all sorts of stuff that we're going to be doing.
So that leads me to another question. As you have gone through the COVID pandemic as a coach, and I'm sure you've had to transition to a tremendous amount of virtual experiences for your clients, you're anticipating, it sounds like, moving back into a more face-to-face on-site events next year. How many events do you plan to do next year if COVID allows us to do that?
As many as humanly possible. But right now, we only have two live events scheduled for next year. Prior to COVID, the folks that would book me were usually CMOs and CEOs of a large group of employed physicians. They would bring me in for like quarterly medical staff meetings to do an hour and a half training over dinner with the significant others. And we used to do 30 or 40 of those a year, and that completely stopped. I actually had my first live in-person event in Vancouver, BC, interestingly enough, about 1 month ago. So we were down for 18 months having to do everything virtually like this.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Dyke, for being on the show. This has been exceptional. I've really enjoyed our conversation, and I know my audience has gotten a lot out of it. So thank you for taking the time to share with us today.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
That wraps up our show for today. Thank you again for listening. I appreciated Dyke taking the time out of his busy schedule to join me today for the interview. Burnout is having a huge impact on our industry. Each day I hear stories of physicians, nurses, and other healthcare workers leaving their jobs feeling burned out. Many, if not all, healthcare organizations are facing staffing shortages related to a lack of retention and recruiting challenges. This places the remaining physicians and staff at an increased risk for burnout. The relationship between moral injury and burnout was explained very well by Dyke. There are many antecedents to burnout, moral injury being one. Our individual stress matrix is important for each of us to understand. Dyke did a great job of explaining how to create your own individual stress matrix and to help you understand how you are being impacted by different stressors in your environment, both professional and personal. If you have not heard episode 15 of Physicians Beyond the Bedside, it is worth listening to. The episode will give you more background on burnout. Dyke will be recording another interview with me discussing helpful detail on making the transition from clinical to non-clinical roles. That future episode will provide additional lessons from his personal experience and his clients' experiences. I will include information in the show notes relevant to today's episodes. I will include a link to Dyke's website, thehappymd.com, as well as other important information. Do not forget to visit my website, physiciansbeyondthebedside.com. I'm always interested in your feedback and comments about the show. You can leave me feedback and comments at my website. I enjoy getting questions, comments, and feedback from you, my listeners. I'm happy to answer any questions that you have that you leave in the comments section at my website. I also encourage you to join the group I have created on Facebook, Physicians Beyond the Bedside. Visit the site on Facebook and ask the administrator of the site to allow you to join the group. Please tune in for the next episode of Physicians Beyond the Bedside. Don't forget to subscribe to my podcast using your favorite podcast player. That way you will not miss a single episode. As always, take good care of yourselves and good luck moving beyond the bedside.